Marge Piercy, June Jordan, Denise Levertov, Nikki Giovanni, Sharon Olds, Susan Griffin and Alice Walker, Gwendolyn Brooks and Louise Gluck, Sandra Cisneros and Anna Castillo, Leslie Marmon Silko and Mitsui Yamada. I'd like to remember Joy Harjo and Wendy Rose. And who would you like to remember?
May Sarden,
okay. Anyone else?
Maribella Sewer.
Maya Angelou. Maybe we would want to name ourselves.
Or others.
Yes. Karen Herseth Wee is a poet, I know that. I am a poet. There are many poets here, I am certain. In fact, I would like to define a poet this morning as a woman who has listened to the cry of the spirit within her and has come to listen to that sacred part of herself. I think that no other poet recognized this as radically, perhaps, as Endozaki Shange, who at the end of For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide When a Rainbow Is Enough, wrote, "I love God in myself. I found God in myself, and I loved her fiercely." Did any of you see that Koryo poem? Marvelous expression of the deeply held silences in women's lives, silences about subjects that have been considered taboo, that have been considered subjects that only belong to the very private lives of women and could never be uttered in public, let alone in literature. And so when we talk about listening to the sacred in lives of women, we have to begin with the silences, because those silences are deep. They're centuries old. And I think this morning I want to make this a very personal session, so I invite you to think about your own lives as we go through these different parts of what it means to listen to the sacred.
Is this a unisex session?
Unisex. So we're talking about listening to the sacred in the lives of women, and we've gotten to the place where we named a few women poets, and then we said, why are we able now to list so many women poets? And before, I think, the early part of the century, that was very difficult. Became much more possible in the 1960s, when women like Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton began writing what was later called confessional poetry. And I think that's an awkward tag in a way, because a lot of poets have written what I call confessional poetry, that is, telling the truth about one's life and using I to mean myself. I think of the romantic poets, for example, Wordsworth and Coleridge and Shelley and Keats. In some ways, their poetry was very confessional. This power to break the silence, as Marilyn Sewell calls it in her book, Cries of the Spirit, which, by the way, I ordered and is available in the bookstore should you want to pick it up. Marilyn Sewell describes this as monumental, these silences, the multitudes of feelings and understandings that we have discounted as not real because we have never heard them expressed by another. So they didn't exist because we never heard them expressed. And I think penetrating those silences has been very difficult for women simply because they didn't regard them as real. That's a philosophical issue. Because it has not been spoken, it must not exist. I think also those silences have to do with traditional expectations that have been placed on women, and I don't mean to spend a lot of time on this. This is something that's almost hackneyed by now. But Tilly Olson wrote a book called Silences, in which she talked about those expectations. Catherine Mansfield, for example, who is also a writer, being called by her husband. Now, I need to remind you maybe from time to time that these people deeply loved one another, okay, Catherine and John Mansfield, but she remembers how often her writing was interrupted as John would call, "A cup of tea, Tig, a cup of tea." And then she knew that it was time for her to make the tea. You know, this is Great Britain and it was tea time. So there have been those expectations that have caused women to be silent simply because it was difficult with children, with a family, to have the time to write. And then there, of course, there is a third cause of silences, and I think that is that women have felt in some ways that they are not heard, even when they do speak. And I don't know if any of you have had this, and this includes the men in the group, but have you ever been in a meeting when you made a point and it was completely, for some reason, not heard? No one listened. You know, and this morning our subject is listening to the sacred. Well, if we regard each person as a vessel of what is like God, then that person's words are just as sacred as any other person's words. And yet, you've had those experiences, I'm sure, in which your remark was just, you know, it went out someplace. It's out there in the pine trees, I suppose. And then another person says virtually the same thing, usually a man. And you hear the president or the boss or the whoever's in charge say, "As Herman said," you know, and then this point is again expressed. So women have had that feeling. Whether this is something that can be, well, actually I have read studies in which attempts have been made to objectively validate this point. Silence, then, is the first topic of some of this poetry, and I have copies of the poem here by Marge Piercy. Which is entitled "Unlearning to Not Speak." And one of the things I love about this poem, do we have enough copies? One of the things I love about this poem is that right away, in the title itself, at least those of you who have ever taught English will recognize a sort of infringement, right? What is it? Split infinitive, okay. And this is very interesting to me because I read recently in a linguistics text that we only say that that split infinitive is a problem because English grammar was somehow based upon, the first grammar texts were based upon a study of Latin in which it's impossible to split the infinitive. It's not impossible in English, and sometimes it sounds more natural to do so than not to do so. So you see, right away in the title, she's making a clever point. Blizzards of paper in slow motion sift through her. In nightmares, she suddenly recalls a class she signed up for but forgot to attend. Now it is too late. Now it is time for finals. Losers will be shot. Phrases of men who lectured her drift and rustle in piles. Why don't you speak up? Why are you shouting? You have the wrong answer, wrong line, wrong face. They tell her she is womb man, baby machine, mirror image, toy, earth mother, and penis poor, a dish of synthetic strawberry ice cream rapidly melting. She grunts to a halt. She must learn again to speak, starting with I, starting with we, starting as the infant does, with her own true hunger and pleasure and rage. Now, could I get your sort of honest reaction to this poem? Don't be afraid to say that it's offensive, because I think on some level it is. Is it offensive?
Well, she's angry, and lots of times we don't like to hear anger. It's not nice.
Yes. So, does she use offensive language?
Some.
Okay. Well, maybe we've become accustomed to it, but can you imagine when this poem first came out, you know, in the 1970s, even, I'm not certain of the exact publication date, but Marge Percy's poetry dates from the 60s and 70s, and she's still writing. It was very offensive to say these things. First of all, as Karen has said, she's angry and she's letting it be known. And this is an unladylike thing to do. Is there any other reaction that you would like to?
Jen, the other thing though that strikes me is that the part about the nightmares is sort of familiar, but it's also, in a way, sort of embarrassing that it's familiar. It's like, and there's certainly a relief in knowing that other people have those kind of nightmares, but on the other hand, it's embarrassing, like, well, don't tell people this. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to know that I have these kinds mm-hmm. of fears.
Yes, because if I do, then I don't fit into yeah. what is here, an academic setting, right?
Right. So that it's that sort of imposter syndrome, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Which is precisely what the women in my classes who are returning to school say to me. They feel like frauds, imposters, they don't belong here, and they have continual nightmares that give them that message. Who am I to think that I can perform academically along with these sharp young people, male or female? They're, you know, intimidated in the classroom. But I think that this speaks to more than just the woman who is returning to school. Now, I'll probably move on unless you have other things to say. Of course, poetry is meant to be heard aloud, isn't it? And it's the sounds of the words themselves. It's the images and metaphors that stay with you. So something like a dish of synthetic strawberry ice cream rapidly melting, that's going to stay with you for a while, and you're going to think about it. What does that mean? Okay. I tried my own hand at a poem in this genre. Well, really, I wasn't trying my hand at it. This poem just came out. And it came out after an English department meeting. here's our next poem. As you can see, I'm warming up to my subject here. I have to take my jacket off. Muriel Rukeyser, who is also a well-published poet, wrote in one of her poems, "What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open." And then that became the title of one of the first anthologies of women's poetry, "The World Split Open." So my poem is called "Dangerous Acts of an Ordinary Kind." I know the terror of common things, like ending a sentence I've begun when the meaning drops off in the middle. A victim of the precipice my brain has become, that grand canyon of possibilities for disaster of the ordinary kind. Or worse yet, the dangerous act of speaking up or shouting out, "I disagree." Imagine the ruckus that would cause, a bottle smashing riot in my brain, and my heart would pound the pavement to escape before the cops. Oh my God, the cops came, their sirens screaming out my name. I probably wonder how a woman with a PhD who has taught English for 20 years in college could write a poem like this. I think that the first step to breaking these silences, to allowing those cries of the spirit to emerge, is to keep a journal. And you've heard this many, many times, I'm certain. This journal has to be a special kind. It has to be the kind in which one feels that one can express the raw truth. And that truth, I use the word raw because it is not exactly aesthetic sometimes. It isn't very pretty. But in order for the first language to come, remember Marge Percy's line, the language of true hunger and pleasure and rage, oftentimes it has to be this kind of language. And so from this step, keeping a notebook or a journal, we get a whole, again, almost a genre of poetry. I can think of a multitude of poems that I could have used to exemplify or illustrate this particular part of breaking silences. And this one that I brought today is by Lorna D. Cervantes. By the way, I've tried to use poets from different ethnic groups as well as poets who express these different subjects or topics.
What an interesting combination of names. Lorna.
Not Cervantes' name. 1954 is the date of her birth, that you see, not the date of the poem's publication. Does everyone have a copy of it? The Woman in My Notebook. The woman in my notebook has escaped. She is a prickly pear woman, a thunder and spit woman, a spiteful woman. She is armed. She winks, a dangerous Harley Davidson dried blood grin. She is a frightening woman, but she is the clasp in my pointed pocketbook poor life. She closes and opens me. I stop bending, stop groveling around in a spooked silence when she enters, elegant as a ginkgo, breathtaking. A tide pool of lavender and crimson singing with spikes. She has broken the rules of poetry, and I find her now, a fine powder, the color of goldenrods in my hair, smudged across my meek sweater, under my breath. A fine woman, the woman I have always tried to keep subdued, under lock and ink. Anything you want to say about this poem? Which of those images really speaks to you, or do you find kind of fresh and provoking?
Well, under lock and ink, does this mean that she writes and then she doesn't let herself come out? Mm-hmm. Because it's in the written word.
Mm-hmm. It could be. Do you have another idea about that? It's definitely a play on the expression, isn't it, under lock and key?
Mm-hmm. It sounds like she's using the writing to subdue herself.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end, you were talking about the journal as a way to let the writing free yourself, and mm-hmm. to let yourself out.
Right.
But that last part sounds like she actually has been using the writing to keep herself underground a little better.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps to keep it under control.
Because it controls her. That she's writing and not just not showing anyone or letting that come out, the things that she's written.
Yeah, you know, in real life, she's doing herself, but mm-hmm. not so much.
I mean, she could be letting it out in her writing, but just not letting her writing out.
Well, that's making a contrast between the Woman in My Notebook that begins and the poetry that she publishes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess your name again is
Kara.
Tara?
Kara.
Kara, I'm sorry. Kara's point is pretty close to the one that I had thought about. You know, I write these marginal notes, and I guess I said here, the ink becomes the key which unlocks the fine power under her breath. You know, the word as power. And there's another play on words, I think, because sometimes when I read this poem, I slip and I say, powder, the color of, you know, but it's not powder, is it? It's power, you know, which is, a kind of explosive or almost threatening word in a way.
I like the combination of meek sweater because mm-hmm. that's one of the places where she's talking about her outsides.
Mm-hmm.
And the outsides probably seem meek to other people, but the woman in the notebook is not.
Mm-hmm. Now, this I think, now we're getting at what is at the heart of this poem, and I think that is an outer inner conflict or either, yeah, or image, yes. And I find this in so much poetry by men and women, but now in the case of women, I think there's a sense in which if this inner woman, this woman in my notebook, were to get out, she would be handled straight away with a chain like Emily Dickinson's Woman, you know, the poem I'm talking about, Much Madness is Divine Sense. I think that sense that women who behave as their insides would tell them to behave are considered dangerous, you see. So, societally speaking, she has to control that power in some ways. But the notebook, it seems, it's a paradox in a way, that the notebook and the ink could allow that to happen, because it's also a way of helping her to control her behavior. You know, she's not being locked up in the literal prison of society, is she? Because this notebook has allowed her to come outside of that. I don't know how many of you have paper or pens. I didn't ask you to bring. How many people have a pen or a pencil with them? Okay. Well, maybe that's enough for us to try this. I did bring another book with me, which the bookstore also has, and this one's by Gabrielle Rico, who has done a lot of work on right brain activity. Maybe you know The Natural Way to Write, which was one of her first publications. And she has written this book called Pain and Possibility, Writing Your Way Through Personal Crisis, which I actually used to write my way through a personal crisis that took the better part of a year for me to emerge from. And it happened to be, in this case, the death 6 months apart of my parents, which affected me very deeply. The grieving process encompassed far more than I had imagined it would. After all, they were old, they had led full lives, you know, and then suddenly I was just hit with this. So this book actually was given to me by a friend who last summer lost her infant daughter. And I wrote to Susan, you know, I hope this book will help you in your grieving experiences. It's helped. And so now it's our shared book for the process of dealing with crisis. At any rate, one of the things that Gabrielle recommends is doing a kind of cluster exercise to get yourself started. We've spoken about silences now, and I think one of the most difficult things is feeling paralyzed by the silence. And writing, of course, I'm an English teacher, so naturally I would advocate writing, but writing is one of the ways to get yourself out of that paralysis. And so as an exercise now, if you have a pen and you can just use the back of one of these sheets that I've handed out. If you could cluster on this conflict between outer and inner, and clustering is a way of free associative thinking. So if you don't really like free association, you might want to write a list instead of drawing the bubbles here. But
your Calvinist list writer.
Right. I'm not going to suggest what you'll put in your bubbles here, but the idea is to become more concrete with this outer-inner image that we're talking about by filling these bubbles with what you think is the outer-inner conflict in your life. For example, I guess I would have to say, I would have to use my dress or my appearance as one of those, because I definitely think that there's a conflict between the way I present myself externally and the way I feel internally. So my dress would be, or my appearance would be, one of those things. And if you could just cluster for a minute on this, it only takes a couple of minutes, and then I'll tell you what to do next after you finish that. Clustering should happen quickly. You don't really need to think too much, because we're working here with a seed idea. A seed idea should have associations coming rather quickly. Okay, then the next step, Gabrielle Rico calls a word sketch. This is clustering. The next step, I suppose, might be, if you call free associative right brain activity, the next step combines that with this more left brain organizational ability, and it's called a word sketch. And it can take the form of either poetry. Now, don't be alarmed by that word, because that simply means that you would be writing these things down in what a poem looks like. That is, just line after line, without concern about making complete sentences to the ends of the margins and so on. Or you could do a little prose sketch. So it can be poetry or prose. That just means a narrative. In other words, tell a little story to yourself about all of these different parts that have come from the seed idea, outer, inner. So let's just try that for a minute too. If you, again, if you have your pencil and paper. It's just a brief, evocative expression of your feelings. That's what a word sketch is. You may need a few more minutes to get your thoughts down. If so, please take that time. Just keep on writing. But because there are several people without pens, I don't want to keep them waiting too long. I just wonder if there's anybody who has written down a few lines who would be willing to read for us what you've written. It will be incomplete. It will be fresh, raw. Would you be willing to?
May a man do that? May a male do that?
Of course.
Okay. Well, conflict areas clustering for me would be because I spent my life in a cross-cultural situation, mm-hmm. cultural expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, theirs and mine.
Exactly.
Okay, so who am I? Yours or mine? Your do's may be my don'ts. Her words hide, mine reveal.
Oh. That is really good. I teach a lot of cross-cultural literature, and we're working very hard at Cal Lutheran with the whole challenge of multicultural diversity in the classroom. And that expresses so much of what goes on. Anyone else care to read?
I have something very similar to what this is, but it's also the experience I recently had.
Mm-hmm.
A meeting. I wish to voice a thought that may be stupid. Not sure it's stupid, but sure that someone will find it so. I can't stand up to that, so I stand up. The voice, biding its time deep in my throat, comes out in a roar.
Very good. Anyone else? I think what this illustrates, even though it may be a new experience for some of you, it illustrates the fact that when we are presented with the urgency of getting something down on paper. When somebody says, do it now, you only have this amount of time. It's amazing what emerges. So just think, all of that is in there. It's just waiting to come out. And until it comes out as a cry of the spirit, this is your spirit crying in a cross-cultural situation for understanding, you know? And it's Karen's spirit crying for trust, crying for, you know, the need to be understood, just a human need. If everyone else in that room could know that Karen needed to be understood, you know, I'm sure they would give her that confidence that she is understood. But we all have these feelings of vulnerability and uncertainty, and they're there. They're waiting to emerge. I'm not much of a person for right brain activity. I've been so trained in the opposite. I think David Wee was just saying the other day, you know, anything that smacks of right brain, he sure can't do it because he's just been taught to think logically and to control the way a sentence comes out and so on. But my experience with grieving taught me that I could not always control those things. I had lost control. And so it was the re-entrance for me into poetry. And I have to thank a loss for giving me this gain of really that first language that Piercy is talking about, the language of the infant, the I and the we. I don't know if you understood that in that poem, the language of I, the language of we, but I take it in a sense here to be the fact that she feels that she must connect with other members of the human race. You know, maybe other women, maybe she's denied her association as a woman with other women. That's another quality or characteristic of this poetry, that women begin to see that they need to support one another, and through that support, they give voice to feelings that and thoughts that haven't been validated.
Why is it just women? I mean, don't men have a say?
pretty much the same problem in our culture?
Well, that's a very complex topic. I think that we have spoke about the silences of women and haven't really recognized enough that there are these silences in men also. But because men have had more or less the privilege of publication, you know, and have a much longer history in letters, we just assume that there isn't quite the same struggle for men to voice their thoughts. But I know from living with a man who has had that struggle that it exists, you know, so.
Well, and Robert Bly certainly is one speaking to that need, but it's interesting because the culture discounts him.
Yes.
He's the butt of many jokes, whether you're watching a television program where there's a skit about, you know, men finding their inner self or whatever, but in this culture that values the men don't do that, he is made fun of.
Yes. And, you know, Carol Gilligan's book, In a Different Voice, has in its introduction a line about this being the voice not only of women, this different voice, but of men who also share this, or in whose voices you can hear this tone, this distinctive tone. And I think that in our society, we haven't paid attention to that distinctive tone, male, female, whatever it is, wherever it's coming from.
Same thing is true in the political sphere. I don't want to talk about it. It's very true because the men who espouse the so-called women's issues have borne the same kind of criticism in politics, in public life, as the people who've raised those issues in other spheres of activity. So I think it's the structural support is there, the organizational acceptance is there, for the one voice, whether it's coming out of a male or a female, because women also sometimes speak in men's voices.
Exactly. And I think, you know, in some ways I'd like to say it's time for the sort of separatist nature of women's studies to come to a close. And yet, if that happened, there are women who would never speak, who would never learn about issues that are particularly female in characteristic. So I think the two have to go alongside of each other. You know, we have to continue this development of paying attention to women's issues, and at the same time, we need to draw men's issues into the... And eventually, my hope is that, not that it become gender-free, but that we can freely speak of it, no matter what our gender perspective is, that we can freely speak of these as human issues.
I used to refer to myself in Wharton Seminary as a feminist. Mm-hmm. And I feel that perfectly appropriate designation, even though I'm a male.
Yes, I do too. Although I think some feminists would disagree with you, but I disagree. Well, now we've talked about two steps so far in listening to cries of the spirit. The first, breaking through silences. The second, keeping a notebook or a journal. And we've even illustrated how you can keep your own notebook or journal. You can continue this process of clustering and writing word sketches or poems from it. Every time you think of a seed idea, just jot it down and cluster or begin to write a list, and then out of that can come your expression of what is sacred to you. And I think I am defining the sacred this morning as what is deeply held. What is deeply held inside of you as so true to your experience that it must be holy. It must be holy. Because it is, to play on words, holy you. And then the next step, the third step, is to break the rules. This is a hard one for me. I've been rule conscious all my life. I was a good little girl. I've been a good little wife, a very good mother. And I'm a people pleaser all the way, so to break the rules is tough. Out of this comes this prickly pear woman of Lorna D. Cervantes' poem, the woman whose power is kind of frightening, and she wants to keep it, you know, she wants to keep this clasp on her notebook, because what if it should emerge, you know, this is a frightening person. But I have another poem. The next poem is by Louise Iverson, and it's entitled Outrage, so I guess we know what the subject is. know, actually, I'm not familiar with this poet. So I just have, I ran across her in this book, Cries of the Spirit. And, but with a name like Iverson, you know, one thinks, oh, she might be related to me. And I'm not sure I could write a poem like this. There's something in my Swedish heritage that forbids it, I think.
Does anybody have one?
It is not so much cooking, but being cooked that gets me. When the chicken goes in the oven, I'll be caught there too. My head in the oven, along with the gizzards and lungs. One wing caught with mine. Heart, liver, entrails, embroiled. Boiled to a pink, tasty succulence, and then devoured. Impaled on your incubi, I will not be, nor stay to argue why not. I who abandon all, who profess to love me, mother, father, brothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, husband, child, know what love means. Love is that which detains. That magic of detention which you need from me, but which tears a woman. The power of life is the integration of life, is the integration of energy, and if you disintegrate, I will not help you. If you spatter red and bitter and rotten on the sidewalk, I will not pick you up, nor suckle you, nor bathe your wounds, nor mend your torn socks. I, a year ago, would have said, nestle your little broken head on your mammy's breast, you poor broken child of the universe. But now I say, scram! I may glance your way to laugh, and I may toss you a penny. For you who have condemned me as witch, as mother, I have no more any pity. For you who have despised me as succubi, as ball breaker, I tell you, you puke in your own folly. My passion is mine, nor am I vampire, nor banshee, nor screamer, nor waiting. I have turned away, and I face a distance I have not run. I raise my fist beside the door of my dreams, and I take time, my time, all of it, in my hands. Now that's an appropriate expression. As I said, I probably could not have written this poem, and yet at one point in my life, as a mother of three children under 2.5 years, I probably uttered thoughts similar to these in my mind. Three babies do not permit you much time for yourself. And when your husband is campus pastor and he's working 16 to 18 hours a day, you really don't have a lot of, help with that kind of work. And I read Alta, a woman who calls herself Alta, period. I read her little book, Mama, when I was in the midst of these mothering years. And I thought, how did she dare to say that? How did she dare to tell the truth that sometimes you just feel like throwing them on the bed and slamming the door shut and saying, you have taken too much of my life, I'm just through with you. Now, lest this become too confessional,
watch out.
I hope you'll understand that. Remember, I was also a good mother. what do you have to say about this poem? Yes.
Reading this, it strikes me that with Christianity, at least the way that I was brought up on Christianity, I was always told to love selflessly, kind of thing. And as I've been becoming more aware of the women's issues and stuff at school, this sort of feeling has come up in me, but at the same time I've got that tug that says, no, mm-hmm. love has to be selfless. And so with women who are trying to become more empowered, where do we find the balance between this kind of mm-hmm. need to collect yourself and then as well the need to retain this kind of love? And that's the struggle that I find.
That is so articulate. I mean, that just puts it into a frame that is very well known to me and to many who are gathered here, I'm sure. So here's the struggle, and you find it all over literature that is written by women, the struggle between that which feels selfish. It feels selfish, but it really just means that you're going to put time into your own life, into your own career, into what you feel is important, and that which is selfless, the selfish and the selfless. And as Christians, we are told that selflessness is the definition of love, right?
Well, but there's love your neighbor as yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you don't love yourself, it becomes very difficult to love anyone else, I think, in my experience. So that you also, I also have to work at the love, and that means the development of time. All those things that you would call loving to another person, you also have to give to yourself.
So
but
the person,
it's hard to do.
Right, it's very difficult to do. And I think that this, the woman, the utterances of this woman caught at a moment in which she felt that she had been, well, all of the images are those of being gobbled up,
right?
All of these
destroyed.
Right. That is one kind of extreme, that it doesn't represent a wholesome balance in one's life. She knows at some level that what is sacred in her has been destroyed. It's been obliterated by this need to give to others. And so all of these ugly words and images emerge. I think we need to remember that she is in extremity, in some kind of extremity, when she writes this poem. And that it is a voice, it's a persona that is speaking here.
And she's able to do it on paper, but you don't know for sure if she's able to do it actually. It's interesting when you look at it visually that the eye is all dominant.
I know.
That's
on
it.
Yes.
Off to the side.
Right, swung off here.
Off to the side,
right.
Off in the corner.
Or you could say, I mean, another way of looking at that, I suppose, is that the eye is pronounced, that it is almost exaggerated by putting it, being put out there. In the
space.
Margin.
She gives it space.
Yes. But she is not going to, apparently, be anymore this self-sacrificing woman. She's not going to define nurturance as self-sacrifice. Is there another kind of nurturance? Is nurturance possible without this kind of self-sacrifice? I think I'll leave that question in the air and move on because we have a couple more poems and not enough time, okay? I'd like to just sum that up by saying that this speaker refuses the role of victim. And I think that we have had problems, really, in our society from her personal inner experience and her understanding of systemic social injustice, which is an important recognition. In a phrase, the personal becomes political. I'd like to pause a minute and give some characteristics of contemporary women poets, and I am borrowing heavily here from Marilyn Sewell in her introduction to Cries of the Spirit. First of all, as you've noticed, there's an emphasis on feeling, authentically based in the writer's daily experience. Secondly, the language is very direct. It's painfully honest. It's sometimes conversational, common speech, earthy, and even obscene. And thirdly, the subject matter comes directly from the lives of these women. It's the language, as Marilyn Sewell says, of clean towels and tea kettles, menstruation, abortion, pregnancy and childbirth, love and friendship, the preparation of food, the protection of the very young and the very old. So you just find a whole panoply of subjects in this poetry, but many of them have never been written about before. And I was just noticing the spate of books on menopause that have come out recently, and menopause was one of these taboo subjects. Nobody talked about it, and now suddenly we have all these books, and I'm certain that we're going to have poetry about menopause as well. Okay, my fourth point is that listening to the cries of the spirit means redefining women's bodies. And this maybe is going to sound trite to you, but we know that this dualism, this mind-body dualism, has affected women negatively over the centuries, that women have been identified with body and with earth and with nature because of what their bodies biologically are capable of doing. And that has meant in many ways that they were thought to be almost mindless creatures, that is, incapable of studying Latin and Greek and all of those rites of passage that would deliver them into the places where poetry is written, where belles lettres are produced and so on, as well as many other circles, as Jackie's going to tell us this week. Our bodies have been associated with nature or with matter as opposed to spirit, because we, like nature, bring things to birth and continue the life cycle. Once women, as we know, were venerated for this capacity, and whole religions sprang up around what we now call goddess worship. And then those religions tended to disappear or fade, and now they're being revived again, some of them. Some never did disappear, it's just that in the sort of dominance of other more patriarchal religions, we didn't notice them. Weir Mitchell is an example of an intelligent late 19th century physician who knew little about women's bodies, so little that he thought all of their ailments, physical and mental, stemmed from the uterus, because that was the one organ women had, you know, that men didn't, and so they must come from there. And so his treatments, in addition to very long rest cures, included the injection of some very foreign substances into the uterus. I won't mention these. Gabriel Rico actually quotes Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who is the author of the Yellow Wallpaper, and it's almost autobiographical short story, a blood-chilling tale in a way, about a woman who is given this rest cure that Weir Mitchell prescribes. The woman's husband in the story is a physician, and he is prescribing this rest cure. And it involves denying her all implements of writing. She wants to write. She's a very imaginative woman. But since she must simply rest to be restored, paper and pencil are taken away from her. But at first, she does a little writing before she's denied those materials. And she says, "I don't know why I should write this. I don't want to. I don't feel able. But I must say what I feel and think in some way. It is such a relief." Now notice that she knows the instrument of her cure, and yet she complies with those who tell her that writing has to be forbidden. So a woman's body has been thought of as really just too frail to undertake these more intellectual pursuits. And this late 19th century example, in many ways we say, well, we've overcome this, and yet in some ways we have not. So I'm going to summarize about 8 or 9 decades of redefining women's bodies by saying that this is a subject now of women's literature and women's poetry as a part of that. A poem celebrating this new perspective of the body is Anne Sexton's In Praise of My Uterus. Now, can you imagine such a poem being written at Mitchell's time?
I can imagine reading it in college.
And I'm just going to read an excerpt from it. "Sweet weight, in celebration of the woman I am and of the soul of the woman I am and of the central creature and its delight, I sing for you. I dare to live. Hello, spirit. Hello, cup. Fasten cover. Cover that does not contain. Hello to the soil of the fields. Welcome, roots." Now, I must say that I've never written a poem in celebration of my uterus. I think that this is a wonderful poem in a way, because she is clearly redefining a woman's body and the parts of her body that have essentially caused her so much physical and psychological trouble. Another step, I think, in listening to cries of the spirit means revisioning women's experiences. And to illustrate this, I'm going to use Susan Griffin's poem, "Love Should Grow Up Like a Wild Iris in the Field." Susan Griffin is an eco-feminist, and she wrote Women in Nature, The Roaring Inside Her in the 1970s. It revolutionized my teaching about ecology, and I think it's still well worth reading, even though many later books by eco-feminists have come out. She's also written about eating disorders, body image, pornography, lots of subjects. Love should grow up like a wild iris in the fields, unexpected after a terrible storm, opening a purple mouth to the rain with not a thought to the future, ignorant of the grass and the graveyard of leaves around, forgetting its own beginning. Love should grow like a wild iris, but does not. Love more often is to be found in kitchens at the dinner hour, tired out and hungry, lingers over tables and houses where the walls record movements, while the cook is probably angry and the ingredients of the meal are budgeted, while a child cries, "Feed me now," and her mother, not quite hysterical, says over and over, "Wait, just a bit, just a bit." Love should grow up in the fields like a wild iris, but never does really startle anyone. Was to be expected, was to be predicted, is almost absurd, goes on from day to day, not quite blindly, gets taken to the cleaners every fall, sings old songs over and over, and falls on the same piece of rug that never gets tacked down, gives up, wants to hide, is not brave, knows too much, is not like an iris growing wild, but more like staring into space in the street, not quite sure which door it was, annoyed about the sidewalk being slippery, trying all the doors, thinking, if love wished the world to be well, it would be well. Love should grow up like a wild iris, but doesn't. It comes from the midst of everything else, sees like the iris of an eye, when the light is right, feels in blindness, when there is nothing else, when there is nothing else, is tender, blinks and opens face up to the skies. Well, what's the redefinition here? What's the revisioning of a woman's experience that's going on here, do you think?
I think it's really interesting to read this with the outrage poem, because this one gives some of that sense. I mean, the thing that really struck me about the outrage poem is that she says, a year ago I would have said, but now I say, and then there's this thing about having been condemned and having been despised for what she did. And yet this Susan Griffin poem, is one of my favorite poems ever, is much more realistic in a way that I think makes you less vulnerable. If you're realistic about, look, this is, it should be beautiful, like a wild iris, and it's not always.
But, I mean, what follows from that is that you look for love in these unexpected, I mean, this is the definition of love.
Right.
Love is, you know, I'm going to sound like the gospel now, you know.
Right.
Believes all things, ignores all things.
Right, but it's a sort of realism that says, this is what it really is like in these ordinary things, and it's still something beautiful. It's just not the romantic image that it should be like.
That's right. It's not the romantic image. It's an image that comes out of kitchens.
Right.
When the child is screaming, "Feed me now." Okay, we're almost at the end of our time. I have one more poem, and that is a poem by Sonia Sanchez, which illustrates, I think, that listening to the cries of the spirit means not only listening to yourself, but to the cries of all women, to the cries of all human beings. And Sonia Sanchez takes us on a trip, really, through her present into her past in that beautiful way that African American poets have come to express now, of legacies. I think of Nikki Giovanni's poem Legacies, and I'll read this one, and of Maya Angelou's Africa. And well, while we're talking to Maya Angelou, her poem Phenomenal Woman, which is one of her favorites. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that
one.
Lots of these in this book.
I took most of these, except the one by Sonia, from the book. So. And then, of course, my own is not in the book.
It's not in the book.
No, sorry.
Yeah,
thanks. But it will be published in Valparaiso's journal, The Crescent, this fall. That one changes that. Okay. present. This woman vomiting her hunger over the world, this melancholy woman forgotten before memory came, this yellow movement bursting forth like Coltrane's melodies all mouth, buttocks moving like palm trees, this honey-coated Albanian woman, raining rhythms of blue-black smiles, this yellow woman carrying beneath her breast pleasures without tongues, this woman whose body weaves desert patterns, this woman, wet with wandering, reviving the beauty of forests and winds, is telling you secrets. Gather up your odors and listen as she sings the mold from memory. There is no place for a soft black woman, and there is no smile green enough or summertime words warm enough to allow my growth. And in my head, I see my history standing like a shy child, and I chant lullabies as I ride my past on horseback, tasting the thirst of yesterday tribes, hearing the ancient black woman, me singing hey, 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 ya, 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 hey, 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 ya, hey, hey, ya, 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 like a slow scent beneath the sun. And I dance my creation and my grandmother's, gathering from my bones like great wooden birds spread their wings while their long-legged laughter stretches the night. And I taste the seasons of my birth, mangoes, papayas, drink of my woman coconut milk, stalk the ancient grandfathers sipping on proud afternoons, walk with a song around my waist, tremble like a newborn child, troubled with new breaths. And my singing becomes the only sound of a blue-black magical woman walking, womb ripe, walking, loud with mornings, walking, making pilgrimage to herself, walking. I love that line, making pilgrimage to herself. It sums up so much. Well, I thank you for coming this morning. Our time is up, but if any of you want to stay around and talk a bit, I'd be happy to do that with you. Thank you for listening to these cries of the spirit.